doors to the former dining room, shutting in those black things from the other place, the place under the floor, unless they could waft under the door jamb and in with us. I hoped the rest of them would just disappear. If Elgin wanted to fuck with them, that was on him. I was done. But first there was the matter of Devereaux. I told Elgin to help me sit him up so what was left of him wouldn't choke. We lifted his top half, Elgin on one side, me on the other, our hands meeting and clasping behind Devereaux's back. Blackish red tears ran from the corners of his eyes. Blood and something else. I didn't want to know what the something else was. I slapped his cheek and bent to the ear on my side and told him to wake up, snap out of it, afraid of what his eyes would look like if he did. His eyes opened. They were bloodshot and gray as they had been, but empty of understanding. Elgin snapped his fingers in front of his face. Nothing changed. I darted my fingers at his eyes, and nothing changed. He was a breathing, man-sized doll.
Oh, my God. Will he come back?
I don't know. Will he? You're the scientist. Elgin raised one of Devereaux's hands. It only hung there until he put it down again.
We'll give it an hour, he said.
We gave it 2. Most of the black tendrils were gone by then, but there were yet a few, and Elgin donned nitrile gloves and a face mask from one of his desk drawers and collected them in a plastic bag. I tried to stop him, but he wouldn't listen. I thought they might melt away in his hand, but they didn't. One of them curled around his gloved forefinger, and he had to detach it by scraping along the inside of the bag. You're a fool to mess with those things, I said. And he repeated, proof. It wasn't good to be chained to him as I now was. The teacher of mathematics had become a drooling mannequin who showed no signs of coming back, and I had to deal with that, not for Elgin, but for myself. At least the former teacher and present idiot wasn't married with children. I thought, I am on the hook. I thought, fuck it, drive on. Did you give him the check?
What? No. I always keep the check until after the run is complete and they're ready to go home. You know that.
Burn it. He never came, like the other one, Bilson. What a way to wake up to the world. I got his keys out of a piss-damp pocket. We got him out to his car, carrying him like a sack of laundry that's still wet and heavy, and put him in the passenger seat. He leaned forward and put his forehead on the Chevy's dashboard as if praying to Allah. I told Elgin to push him back, and I fastened the seatbelt. Not all cars had them, but this one did. It was a 3-point harness, the kind with a chest strap, and that held him more or less upright, although his head was down with his chin on his chest. I thought that was all right. Anybody who saw him might think he was asleep. One of those black filaments came out of his nose and floated toward me, but Elgin was still wearing his nitrile gloves. He snatched it out of the air and blew it away. I wondered if there were more inside Devereaux.
What are you going to do with him?
I don't know. I got in the Chevy and drove away back down Lake Road. I looked in the rearview mirror and saw Elgin standing in his driveway and watching. I drove with the windows open and the air conditioner on full. I was wearing a pair of Elgin's nitrile gloves, had been since I got in the car. Twice more black things came out of his nose and once from his gaping mouth, but the moving air took them out the passenger window. I drove in the direction of Lewiston, Auburn, but had no intention of going that far. I knew where he lived. His Minot Avenue address had been on the release form, but there was no way I was going to drive him into the Twin Cities, not with still having to get him over into the driver's seat. I needed a quiet place to do that. I was on Route 119 in Waterford when I came to the Wolf Claw rest area. In the heat of the day, no one was there. I parked under the trees and went around to the passenger side and opened the door and unclipped the seat belt, and Devereaux went leaning forward until his forehead was resting on the dashboard again. I wished I had asked the gentleman scientist for one of his masks, but what good would covering my mouth and nose do? The black filaments had come out of Devereaux's eyes. They could just as easily go into mine. I would just have to hope they were all gone. I hadn't seen any for the last 10 miles or so, but they might have come out and flown away through the open window while I was watching the road. I tilted him toward me and caught him and pulled him out of the car and dragged him around the hood. He was wearing loafers, and one of them came off. His blank eyes stared raptly into the sun. I got him behind the wheel, but it took time and wasn't easy. I hadn't expected it to be. He was breathing, but dead inside, and I knew from Nam that dead people are heavier. They shouldn't be, but they are. Gravity is greedy for the dead and wants them in the ground. Just my opinion, but others share it. He tilted forward again, and I grabbed him by the back hair and pulled him up before his forehead could hit the horn. I fastened his seatbelt, and his head sank until his chin was on his chest. I thought that was all right. I hoped no one would come until I got the righteous fuck out of there. I put the keys in the ignition and closed the door and started down Route 119. I had walked about a quarter of a mile before I remembered the shoe and went back. Somebody will be there by now, I thought. Someone who looked in the open window of the Chevy with the St. Dom sticker on the bumper and said, "Hey, mister, wake up," and, "Hey, mister, are you all right?" And, "By the way, mister, what are those black things coming out of your nose?" But no one was there. I picked up the loafer and opened the driver's door again and put it on his foot. Then I brushed out the tracks going around the front of the car, the ones his heels had made, and set off walking again. About 5 miles down the road, my shadow now starting to drag out long behind me, I came to a combination general store and gas station with a phone booth on the side. I had enough change in my pocket so I didn't have to go into the store where someone might see and remember me. That probably would have been all right, but by then I was thinking like a thief or a murderer. I called Elgin, wanting a ride. Elgin didn't answer, and I had come alive enough to feel scared. I had a plan now, one that might get me and the gentleman scientist in the clear, but plans change. I kept thinking of him saying, "Proof, proof." I kept thinking he was crazy, and then I thought of how I knew that. I knew it all along, but said fuck it, and drove on. I turned back the other way, my shadow now drawing out longer and longer before me rather than behind. A car came, and I stuck out my thumb. It passed me by. So did the next one. But then came a pickup that slowed and stopped. The man driving had a weathered red face under a gray brush cut.
"How far are you going?"
"Castle Rock. It's where my father lives."
"Well, hop in. Did you serve? You got that look about you, and you're the right age for the current fuckadiddle."
"Yes, sir, I did."
"So did I. About 10,000 years ago. Semper Fi if you like it, and Semper Fi if you don't."
He let out the clutch with a jerk and talked about Korea and asked me what about those peaceniks. I said, "That's right." He said, "Shipped them all out there to hate Fucksbury," and I said, "That's right." He offered me a beer from behind the seat. I took it, and when he said, "Take another, soldier," I did. Half an hour later, he pulled over to the curb of Main Street in the Rock.
"We're going to beat those gook sons of bitches."
"Yes, sir."
"Take care of yourself, son."
"That's the plan." Off he went. By then it was evening and more thunderheads building up in the west. I walked the 6 miles out to Lake Road. By the time I got there, the rain was beating its way across the lake again. Lightning flashed. Thunder rolled. The smell of ozone in the air like an unburned burning. My car was still parked next to Elgin's Mercedes. I went inside. He hadn't turned on the lights, and the hall was a bowl of shadows.
"Elgin?"
I got no answer. The living room was empty, the books knocked over. Beyond the wall of sleep was face up. On the coffee table was a glass ashtray, a pack of Winstons, and his Zippo. I took the Zippo and put it in my pocket. I went to the former dining room, thought about going into the room with the couch, fortunately thought better of it, I went into the room with the desk instead, and sat in my chair and looked through the one-way glass. What was left of Elgin, the gentleman scientist, was on the couch, Polaroid scattered all around, the beaker shattered among the photographs. His head was in what looked like a black sack. Some of the photographs, those that were face up, showed it forming over his sleeping face. The picture of the red house with the green door was also on the floor, and so was the plastic bag into which he had put his samples. Now the bag was empty. The black sack on his head was made of those filaments. It sucked in and out from what was left of his mouth as he breathed. I thought about him telling me of endless universes both out there and below our very feet. I thought of a face sliding down a man's skull. I thought of a helicopter on fire, sinking into the very sea of napalm it had created. I thought of putting Devereaux's shoe back on his foot. I thought of all the unknown and unknowable nether creations that might exist beneath a barrier of dreams. I thought that, yes, plans change. Elgin could no longer get out of this, but maybe I still could. Some of the black filaments saw me and rose from the black bag and crossed the room and plastered themselves on the glass. More came, and more. I watched as they squirmed around until they made my name, William Davis. There was a gas stove in the kitchen. I turned on all the burners and blew out the blue gas flowers one by one. I turned on the oven and opened the oven door. A pilot light came on in there, and I blew that out too. As I created this nascent gas bomb, I looked constantly over my shoulder for the black filaments. I was in so king high terror. I was in rung round horror. I closed the windows. I closed the doors. I went around to the guest house and gathered up my belongings in my duffel bag and one suitcase. I put them in the trunk of my car. Then I went back to the stoop and waited, clicking the top of the lighter up and down. Lightning pan-fried the lake and thunder rolled. After about 10 minutes, the rain started. At first just pattering down, the storm's foreplay. I opened the door. The gas was a stench. I flicked the Zippo and got a flame and tossed it and ran for my car. I got there and had just decided nothing was going to happen when the kitchen exploded. The rain came in a deluge as I drove away. In my rear view, I saw the house burning like a candle under a black sky cut with lightning. There were houses and summer cottages on Lake Road, but no one was out in the storm. And if anyone was looking out a window, they would have seen nothing but an amorphous car-shaped blob behind headlights. I drove out of Castle Rock and into Harlow. The rain slackened, then stopped. In my rearview mirror, just before the sun sank behind the mountains in New Hampshire, I saw a rainbow. Then the sun was gone, and the rainbow clicked off like a neon sign. I stayed the night at a motel in Gates Falls and drove to Portland the next morning to the rooming house where I had been living when I worked at Tempo. There was a rooms for rent sign in the front window. I rang the bell and Mrs. Blake answered. You again? Yes, sign says you got a room. That's right, but not your room. It's on the third floor and there's no air conditioning. Is it cheaper than the one on the second? No, I'll take it. The next day, I went back to Tempo and got rehired. I had no plans to spend very long working for Mrs. Frobisher, but I wanted to have a job when the cops came. Pearson was in the break room, so was Diane. There was a talk show on the TV. Diane gave me a crooked little smile and said, "Once more into the breach, dear friends." Pearson was reading the paper, sections piled up around his shoes. He took one look at me and raised the paper again. "So you came back," I said to Diane.
So did you. Didn't work out at Elgin's house?
It did for a while, then didn't. He started getting strange when his experiments didn't work out.
And here we are. All roads lead to Timpo.
Mrs. Frobisher came in.
Who wants a depot at Brune and Cathcart?
She didn't wait for an answer, just pointed to a new woman I didn't know.
You, Janelle. Chop, chop.
Pearson was done with the local section of the paper, so I picked it up. On the bottom of page 1B was a story headlined, Castle Rock Man Dies in Gas Explosion at Darkscore Lake. It said the case was being investigated as an accident or possible suicide. It said that because of heavy rain, the fire hadn't spread. I said, holy shit, my last boss is dead, and showed Diane the story.
Bad luck for him, good luck for you.
She read the story.
Was he suicidal?
I had to think that over. I don't know. The next day I had court. When I went back to the rooming house, two cops were waiting for me in the parlor. One was in uniform, the other was a detective. They introduced themselves and asked how long I had worked for Elgin. I told them about a month. I told them what I had told Diane, that Elgin started to get dinky-dow when his experiments hadn't been panning out, so I left. Yes, I had been living in the guest house, but moved out when I quit the job. No, I hadn't been there when his house blew up. They asked me if I knew a man named Burton Devereaux. I said I knew the name. It had been on Elgin's list of test subjects, but not the man. I'd never seen him. The detective gave me his card and asked me to call him if I thought of anything. I said I would. I asked if the detective thought Elgin had killed himself. Would that surprise you, Mr. Davis? Not a lot. He turned on the gas stove and we found a melted chunk of lighter on what was left of the kitchen floor, so what do you think? What I thought was a smart detective might have wondered if they found the remains of the Zippo in the kitchen, how Elgin could be on his subject's couch in the dining room. But I guess he wasn't that smart. I worked at Timpo until September, then quit and drove to Nebraska. No reason for Nebraska. It was just where I went. I got temporary work on a farm, one of those big agribusiness spreads, and Foreman kept me on after the harvest season passed. I'm here now. It's snowing a blizzard. I-80 is shut down. I sit at this desk thinking of galaxies beyond galaxies. In a little while, I will close this notebook and turn out the lights and go to bed. The sound of the wind will lull me off to sleep. Sometimes I dream of the boondocks and men screaming in fire. Sometimes women screaming in fire. Children. None too, they cry. None too. None too. Those are the good dreams. You might not believe it, but it's true. In the bad dreams, I'm standing outside a red house with a green door. If I tried that door, it would open. I know this. No, one day I will go in and kneel at the living room doorway. Nantu, I will cry. Nantu. But when his final dream comes, there will be no mercy. Not for me. Thinking of Cormac McCarthy and Evangeline Walton. The Answer Man. 1. Phil Parker had the great good fortune, or great ill luck, to meet the Answer Man 3 times during his life. On the first of these occasions, in 1937, he was 25, engaged to be married, and the possessor of a law degree on which the ink had almost dried. He was also caught on the horns of a dilemma
so fierce that his eyes watered each time he thought of it. Nonetheless, it had to be thought about and resolved in one way or the other. To that end, he left his apartment in Boston and came up to the small New Hampshire town of Curry, where his parents owned a summer home. Here, he planned to spend a decision-making weekend. He sat on the deck, overlooking the lake with a six-pack of beer on Friday night. He thought about his dilemma, slept on it, woke up on Saturday morning with a hangover and no decision made. On Saturday night, he sat on the deck overlooking the lake with a quart bottle of old-time ginger ale. He woke up on Sunday morning with no decision made, but with no hangover. A plus, but not enough. When he got back to Boston that evening, Sally Ann would be waiting to find out what he had decided. So he climbed into his old Chevrolet after breakfast and went motoring along New Hampshire back roads on a gorgeous, sunshiny October day. The trees were in full autumn flame, and Phil pulled over several times to admire various vistas. He reflected that there was no beauty like New England beauty at the end of the cycle. As morning drew on toward noon, he scolded himself for dilly-dallying. Getting drunk on beer hadn't solved his problem, sipping ginger ale hadn't solved it, and mooning over fall foliage wouldn't do it either. And yet he suspected that his absorption in the scenery was quite a bit more than communing with nature. It was either part of the solution or his mind's effort to squirm away from a decision that would, one way or the other, set himself and his fiancée on a lifetime course. "It's part of growing up," he told himself. Yes, but the idea of choosing one single thing was abhorrent to him. He knew it had to be done, but that didn't mean he had to like it. Wasn't it a little like picking the prison cell you wanted to spend your sentence in? Your life sentence? That was silly and overblown. Yet it wasn't. His dilemma was simple and clear-cut, as most of the real ball-breakers are. Where was he to practice law? Each choice was full of ramifications. Phil's father was a senior partner in an old Boston law firm of the white shoe variety. Warwick, Lodge, Nestor, Parker, Alberton, and Fry. Sally Ann's father was a senior partner in the same firm. John Parker and Ted Alberton had been best friends since college. They had married less than a year apart, each serving as the other's best man. Phil Parker had been born in 1912, Sally Ann in 1914. They were playmates growing up, and maintained their liking for each other even during that difficult period in early adolescence when boys and girls tend to express a public disdain for the opposite sex, no matter what they may feel privately. The parents on both sides might have been the least surprised people on earth when Phil and Sally Ann began to keep company, as the saying was in those days, but neither couple quite dared to hope that their children's affection would survive 4 years of separation. Vassar for Sally Ann, Harvard for Phil. When it did, the parents were delighted, as were Phil and Sally Ann, of course. Love wasn't the problem, at least not directly, although love played a part, as it almost always does. Curry was the problem, that small town near the main New Hampshire state line, where the Parkers and Albertans had summer homes on adjoining lakefront lots. Phil had been in love with Curry at least as long as he had been in love with Sally Ann, and now it seemed he might have to choose between them. He wanted to hang out his shingle in Curry, although it boasted only 2,000-year-round residents. The downtown area, where Route 23 crossed Route 111, consisted of a restaurant, two gas stations, a hardware store, the A&P, and the town hall. There was no bar and no movie theater. For those amenities, you had to go to North Conway, quite some distance away. There was an elementary school, in those days called a grammar, but no high school. Curry teens made their glum bus ride to Patton High, 10 miles away. There was also no lawyer in town. Phil could be the first. The Parkers and Albertans thought he was crazy to even consider Curry. John Parker was hurt and angry that his son was thinking of not joining the firm where his grandfather had been a senior partner back in the horse and buggy days. He also found it difficult to believe, he said, that a young man who had graduated cum laude from Harvard Law School would even consider practicing in the wilds of New Hampshire, which he called the forgotten wilds of New Hampshire, sometimes after a cocktail or two, the misbegotten wilds. "Your clients will be farmers suing each other over cows breaking down fences," John Parker said. "Your biggest cases will involve poaching or fender benders on Route 23. You can't be serious." But the dismay on his face made it clear that he knew his son might be. Ted Alberton was even angrier than his old friend. He had one special reason to be angry other than the ones John had already voiced to his son. Phil would not be committing a wanton act of destruction upon his future alone. He was planning to take a hostage, that hostage being his daughter. When Phil persisted, Alberton had drawn a line in the dirt, one that was deep and harsh. "I'll forbid the marriage." "Sir," Phil had replied, keeping his voice level and, he hoped, polite, "I love Sally Ann. She says she loves me, and she's of age."
"You mean she could marry you without my consent?" Ted was a big, broad-shouldered man, partial to suspenders, which he called braces. His blue eyes could be warm, but that day they'd been like flints. "That's true. She could. And I like you, Phil. Always have. But if you were to do what you're considering, any marriage would take place without my blessing. And that, I believe, would make her very unhappy. In fact, I rather doubt she'll do it."
Phil had looked into those flinty eyes and understood Ted Alberton was understating the case. He was sure Sally Ann wouldn't do it. Phil didn't know if she would or not, especially if Mr. Alberton decided against a cash dowry. Phil knew Sal understood what he wanted more clearly than their elders, who either wouldn't or couldn't understand at all. And he knew part of her wanted it, too. After all, she'd also grown up spending her summers and the occasional snowy and magical Christmas in Curry. She was willing to listen when Phil told her that he believed Curry and all of southern New Hampshire was going to grow. "It'll be slow getting started," he had told her that summer, when he still had hopes of bringing his parents on board with his tentative plan, if not the Albertans. "The Depression's not really going to end for another 7 years or so, unless there really is a war. My dad thinks there will be, but I don't. The growth is going to start in the North Conway area and spread from there. By 1950, there'll be more highways. More highways mean more tourists, and more tourists mean more businesses. The new people will come from Massachusetts and New York, Sal, and they'll come by the thousands, tens of thousands, to swim in clean lakes in the summer, to watch the leaves change in the fall, to ski in the winter. Your father thinks I'll live poor and die poor. I think he's wrong." Unfortunately, it wasn't 1950 or even 1945. It was 1937, and he hadn't been able to bring any of them around. He hadn't, not yet anyway, dared to ask Sally to commit, which might mean turning her back on her family, or having them turn their backs on her. It seemed horribly unfair, but to leave her dangling on the horns of his dilemma was unfair too. And so he had told her he was going to come up here, spend the weekend, and come to a decision. Either the firm on Commonwealth Avenue, or the little wooden office behind the Curry Town Hall and next to the Sunoco. Boston or Curry. The lady or the tiger. And so far, he had decided. "Absolutely nothing," he muttered. "Gosh almighty." He was on Route 111 now and headed back toward the lake. His stomach was talking to him about lunch,
but it was doing it in low and rather respectful tones, as if it was also abashed by his inability to decide. His greatest wish was that he could make his father and mother understand that the firm was just not right for him, that he would be a square peg in a round hole. The fact that the firm had been right for his father and grandfather, not to mention the Honorable Theodore Alberton Esquire and his father, did not make it right for him. He had tried in every way he could think of to express to them that he might be capable of doing perfectly adequate work at the double brownstone on Com Avenue and still feel desperately unhappy there. Would that unhappiness seep into his home life? It could, and probably would.
Nonsense, his father had replied. Once you get broken in, you'll love it. I did, and you will. A fresh challenge every day. No suits in small claims court over broken plows and stolen farm wagons.
Broken in. What a phrase. It had haunted him through all this spring and summer. It was what you did with horses. Broke them in, worked them until they became nags, then shipped them off to the glue factory. He felt the metaphor, while melodramatic, was also realistic. His mother, who at least sensed that his distress was real, a true thing, was kinder. "You won't know if the firm is right for you until you've tried it," she said, and that was the most reasonable and seductive reasoning put forward to him in favor of the firm, because he knew himself. He had been a very good student of the law. Not good enough to be brilliant, perhaps, but there was no shame in being very good. He wasn't much of a rebel, though, and neither was Sally Ann. If they had been, they wouldn't have been so deeply distressed at the idea of going against the wishes of their parents. They weren't still teenagers, for gosh sake. If he went to work for the firm, Phil suspected he would find aspects of it challenging, and he suspected even more strongly that he would, in time, become broken in. His idea of being the first lawyer in a sleepy little town that might someday grow into an affluent large town, possibly even a small city, would recede. Slowly at first, then, as the first strands of gray appeared at his temples, more quickly. In 5 years, it would seem more dream than desire. There would be children and a house to take care of, more hostages to fortune. And each year, hell, each month, each week, each gosh darn day, it would be more difficult to turn back. A lifetime course. He tried to imagine telling Sally Ann he had settled on Curry. His parents would help them get started, probably, even if the Albertans wouldn't. He had some savings, and so did Sal, not much. It would be hard, but not impossible, perhaps. He suspected Ted Alberton was wrong about his daughter refusing to marry without his blessing. Phil dared to believe he knew Sal better than her father did in that respect. But what would a marriage lacking that blessing be like? Was it fair to either of them to start out with acrimony instead of support? So his mind swung back and forth, town or city, lady or tiger, as he breasted one of the long hills on Route 111. A bright yellow sign, hand-painted, caught his eye. 2 miles to the answer man, it read. Phil grinned, then laughed out loud. It would be nice if there really was such a guy, he thought. I could certainly use a few answers. He drove on and passed another sign soon enough. This one was electric blue. Answer man, 1 mile. Phil topped another long rise, and there, at the bottom of the downgrade, he saw a splash of bright red at the side of the road. As he drew closer, he saw it was a large beach umbrella with hanging scalloped sides. There was a table beneath it. A man sat behind it in the shade. Phil thought the setup looked like the lemonade stands you often passed in the summer. But those were hopeful little kids who had forgotten to add sugar to their puckery brew more often than not, and this wasn't summer, but mid-autumn. More curious than ever, Phil pulled over and got out of his jalopy.
"Hello." "Hello yourself," the answer man responded.
equably enough. He looked to be about 50. His thinning hair was salt and pepper. His face was lined, but his eyes were bright and interested and unaided by specs. He wore a white shirt, plain gray slacks, and black shoes. His long-fingered hands were folded neatly on the surface of his table. A bag like a doctor's satchel rested by one foot. He looked like an intelligent fellow, and Phil got no sense of eccentricity about him. He, in fact, reminded Phil of the dozen or so mid-level and middle-aged lawyers in the firm, solid, respectable men who lacked that final increment of ability which would propel them to partner level. It was that very feeling of comfy, corporate normality that made the man's appearance here beneath a bright red umbrella, sitting in the middle of nowhere in particular, so curious. There was a folding wooden camp chair on the other side of the table. The client's chair, presumably. Three little signs had been set up in a row to face the answer man's prospective customers. "The answer man," read the sign in the middle. $25 per 5 minutes, read the sign on the left. "Your first two answers free," read the sign on the right. "What is this exactly?" asked Phil. The answer man fixed him with a look that was ironic, but not unfriendly. "You look like a smart young man," he said. "A young man who has been to college, judging by the pennant I see on your car aerial. Harvard, no less. 10,000 men of Harvard cry for victory today." "Right," Phil said, smiling. "For they know that over Eli, fair Harvard holds sway." The answer man smiled back.
"Such young fellows as yourself, and girls, are so used to asking questions that they don't even think about what they are asking. And since business has been slow this morning, I'm going to do you a favor of not answering that question, which still leaves you with two free ones, if you want them." Phil thought that even if the guy had a few screws loose, what he said made perfect sense. He had asked a question to which the answer was obvious. For $25, this man would answer questions for 5 minutes. That was what was going on here, and that was all. "Well, say, don't you think 25 smackers for 5 minutes' worth of answers is pretty steep? It's no wonder your biz has been on the slow side." "Well, what is steep?" "No, don't answer that. You're not the answer man. I am. My rates vary according to my location and my prospective customers. I have charged $100 for 5 minutes, and on one storied occasion, I charged 1,000. 1,000 iron men! Yes!
But I've also charged as little as a dime. You might say I charge what the traffic will bear. Answers aren't always painful, young man, but correct answers should never come cheap." Phil opened his mouth to ask if the guy was serious, then closed it again. He could easily imagine the answer man saying, "Yes, I am, and that's your second free question." How would I know the answers you gave me would be true and correct?
"You wouldn't now, but in the course of time you would," said the answer man. "And that's
two," Phil said. He was grinning widely, enjoying the game. He said, "How much course of time are we talking about?" He was no sooner out than he clapped a hand over his mouth, but too late.
"It's been slow today, so I'm going to give you a third free one," the man behind the table said. "The answer, it varies, which helps you get to the truth of my profession, if it's the truth you're seeking, not at all. Do you see what I mean about how easy it is to ask questions that don't aid understanding? It devalues the whole process of asking, doesn't it? Of delving into matters?"
The answer man leaned back in his chair, laced his fingers at the nape of his neck, and gazed at Phil.
"I shouldn't be surprised at how unhelpful the questions of smart people can be, having been in this business for as long as I have. Yet somehow I still am. It's loose. It's lazy. I've often wondered if smart people really understand what answers they seek in life. Perhaps they just cruise along on a magic carpet of ego, making assumptions that are often wrong. That's the only reason I can think of as to why they ask such impotent questions.
Impotent? Really?
The answer man went on as if he hadn't heard.
You asked me how you'd know if my answers were the correct ones. True and correct is how you put it, which was quite nice. So I gave you one for free. If this were the pre-Christmas rush, I would have seen you back into your car and down the road 2 minutes ago.
The breeze gusted, flapping the scalloped edge of the red umbrella and ruffling the wings of the answer man's salt-and-pepper hair. He looked down the empty road with an expression of deep melancholy.
Fall is a slow time for me, and October is the slowest month of all. I think more people are able to find answers on their own in the autumn.
He continued to look along the black ribbon of road winding its way into the blazing trees for a moment. Then his eyes cleared, and he looked back at Phil again.
Why didn't you just ask me something specific?
Phil was caught by surprise.
I don't know what you mean.
What you really wanted to know is if I'm a fake, the answer man said. And if you had asked me what your mother's maiden name was, for example, or the name of your fifth-grade teacher, something I couldn't possibly know unless I am what I say I am, you could have found out.
He shook his head.
People without your intellectual advantages usually ask exactly that sort of question. People with them, people with a Harvard education, let us say, hardly ever do. It goes back to what I said. Smart people labor under a dual disadvantage. They don't know the answers they need, and they don't know what questions to ask. Education doesn't inculcate mental discipline.
You'd think it would, but it's often just the opposite.
Okay, Phil said, nettled.
What is my mother's maiden name?
Sorry, the answer man said, and tapped the sign that said $25 per 5 minutes. For that you need to pay.
You crooked me, Phil exclaimed humorously. He didn't feel humorous. He felt exasperated. With both of them.
Not at all, the answer man replied equably. You crooked yourself.
Phil was about to remonstrate, then didn't. He could see the man's point. This was a kind of intellectual three-card Monte.
It's been interesting, sir, but $25 is a little high for a fellow not long out of college and thinking of starting his own business, so I better get back on the road. It's been fun passing the time of day with you.
As he started away, Phil thought, no, he was sure, that the man sitting beneath the red umbrella would say,
business being so slow and all, maybe I could give you 5 minutes for $20. Hell, I'll make it 15. 15 simoleons, and you can set your mind to rest about all sorts of things.
And when that happened, Phil decided, he was going to pay right up and sit right down. The man was obviously a charlatan and a screw tip in the bargain, but what the hey? He had a 20, a 10, and 2 fives in his wallet. Even with a splurge here, that was more than enough to buy a tank of ethyl for the old jalop and a good lunch at a roadside restaurant. Phil thought that even hearing the questions, spoken right out loud instead of just knocking around in his head, might go a good way toward solving his problem. The self-styled answer man was right about one thing, Phil thought. Getting good answers was mostly a matter of asking good questions. But all the answer man said was,
you drive safe now.
Phil walked to his car, crossed around the slightly dented front fender and looked back. He still expected the answer man to offer him a cut rate, but the answer man seemed to have dismissed Phil entirely. He was looking over toward Vermont, humming and using a small twig to clean beneath his nails. He intends to let me go, Phil thought, nettled all over again. Well, be damned to him. That's just what I'm going to do. He opened the driver's door of his Chevy, hesitated, then closed it again. He took out his wallet. He removed the 20 and one of the fives. Just hearing the questions out loud, he thought again. And I don't have to tell anyone that I stooped to paying a fortune teller during a depression. Also,
It might be worth $25 just to see the smug son of a buck groping around and making excuses when Phil did ask him for his mother's maiden name.
Change your mind? The answer man tucked his nail-cleaning twig into the breast pocket of his shirt and picked up his satchel.
Phil smiled and held out his money. For the next 5 minutes, I'm the one asking the questions.
The answer man laughed and pointed a finger at Phil.
Good one, my friend. I like you. But before I take your money, there's one rule we need to get straight.
Oh, here it comes, Phil thought. The hole he intends to wriggle through.
From his bag, the answer man removed what looked like an old-fashioned Big Ben alarm clock. When he set it on the table, Phil saw it was actually a giant-sized stopwatch with numbers running from 5 to 0.
I am not a psychiatrist or a counselor, nor am I a fortune-teller, although I'm sure that's what you're thinking.
Here's the point. Don't try asking me any questions with "should I" in them. No, should I this? No, should I that? I answer questions, but I'm not going to solve your problems.
Phil, who had planned to ask the fellow if he should join the firm or open his own office in Curry, started to pull back his money. Then he thought, if I can't couch my questions in a way that skirts his "should I" prohibition, what kind of a courtroom lawyer will I make?
I'm in, Phil said, and handed over his money. Into the answer man's bag it went.
I can't keep calling you son, son. Perhaps you'll give me your name.
Phil.
Phil what?
Phil smiled craftily. Just Phil. I think that's all you need, considering we're not going to be together long.
All right, just Phil. Give me a sec to wind this sucker up. And I see you're wearing your own timepiece. Looks like a very fine bulova. So if you care to check it against mine, feel free.
Oh, I will, Phil said. I intend to get my money's worth.
And so you shall.
The answer man wound his oversized stopwatch with a clackety-clack sound very similar to the clock Phil had kept by his bedside during his undergraduate years.
Are you ready?
Yes. Phil sat down in the client's chair. But if you can't answer my first question, I'll have my money back double quick. You'll either give it to me willingly, or I'll take it by force.
That sounds positively brutal, the answer man said.
But he laughed when he said it.
I'll ask again. Are you ready?
Yes. So we begin. The answer man clicked a lever on the back of his clock, and it began to tick.
Your suggestion. What's my mother's maiden name? The answer man didn't hesitate.
Sporin.
Phil's mouth dropped open.
How in the hell did you know that?
I don't want to waste time you've paid for, Phil. But I have to point out that you've asked another question to which you know the answer. I know because I am,
ta-da, the answer man.
Phil felt like he had been tagged by a right hook. He actually shook his head to clear it. The ticking of the answer man's big stopwatch was very loud. The hand was approaching the 4.
What's my girl's name?
Sally Ann Alberton.
No hesitation at all. Phil began to be afraid. He told himself not to be. It was a fine October day, and he was both younger and no doubt stronger than the man on the other side of the table. It must be a trick. Had to be. But that didn't make it any less eerie.
Tempus is fugiting, Phil.
He shook his head again. Okay, I'm trying to decide if I should...
The answer man wagged a finger at him.
What did I tell you about that word?
Phil tried to put his thoughts in order. Mock court, he thought. Think of it as mock court. He's the judge. There's been an objection to your line of questioning. How do you get around it?
Can you answer questions about future events?
The answer man rolled his eyes.
We've already established that, have we not? I said you'd know if my answers were true and correct
in the course of time.
Such an answer presupposes knowledge of the future.
For me, there is no future and no past. Everything is happening now.
What old lady, seance, bullshit, Phil thought. Meanwhile, the black hand on the big stopwatch was almost to 3.
Will Sally Ann agree to marry me when I propose?
Yes.
Will we live in Curry, the town down the road?
Yes.
The big black hand on the stopwatch reached 3, then passed it.
Will we be happy? A broad question and one to which you should also know the answer even at your young age. There will be ups, there will be downs. There will be agreements, and there will be arguments. But on measure, yes, the two of you will be happy.
He somehow knew my mother's maiden name, Phil thought, and Sally's. The rest is just carny fortune-teller guesswork. But why? For a measly $25?
Tempus still fugits, said the answer man.
The ticking of the oversized stopwatch seemed louder than ever.
The hand was past 3 and closing the gap on 2.
Phil had no sane reason to be relieved by what the answer man was telling him, because it was what he wanted to hear, wasn't it? And hadn't he already made his decision about Curry? Wasn't all that horns of a dilemma stuff so much self-dramatization?
And as for Sal, didn't he pretty much know she would marry him, even if he did make moving to rural New Hampshire part of the deal?
Not for absolute sure, not 100%, but 90%?
Abruptly, he changed direction. Tell me where my father was born, if you can.
Again, the answer man did not hesitate. He was actually born while at sea, on a ship called the Mary Bell.
Phil again felt like he'd been socked in the jaw.
It was an old family story, much treasured and often told. Grandfather and grandmother had been returned to America after a pilgrimage to London, where their parents had been born and lived their early lives. Graham had insisted on making the trip even though she was 8 months pregnant by the time they returned. There was a storm. Grandmother's seasickness was so violent it triggered her labor. There was a doctor on board, and he delivered the infant. No one expected baby John to live, but wrapped in cotton batting and fed from an eyedropper, he had. And thus, Philip Yeager Parker, Harvard Law School graduate, became possible. He started to ask again how the man on the other side of the table, hands still neatly folded, could know such a thing, then didn't. The reply would be the same. Because I am the answer man.
Questions crammed his mind like a panicked crowd trying to escape a burning building. The stopwatch hand reached 2 and passed it.
The ticking seemed louder than ever. The answer man waited, hands folded.
Will Curry prosper the way I think it will? Phil blurted.
Yes.
What else? What else?
Sally's father. And her mother, I suppose. Will they come around to us?
Yes, in time.
How long?
The answer man seemed to calculate briefly as the single hand on his clock reached 1. He said,
7 years.
Phil's heart sank. 7 years was a lifetime. He could tell himself the answer man had plucked that number out of thin air, but he no longer believed it.
Your time grows short, just Phil.
He could see that for himself. But he couldn't think of another question except, how long will I live? And the concomitant question, how long will Sally Ann live? Did he want to know either of those things? He did not. But he didn't want to waste his remaining 40 or 50 seconds, so he asked the only thing that came to mind.
My father says there's going to be a war. I say there won't be. Which of us is right?
He is.
Will America be in it?
Yes.
How long before we're in it?
4 years and 2 months.
He was down to 20 seconds now, maybe a little more.
Will I be in it?
Yes.
Will I be hurt?
No.
But that wasn't the right question. It left a loophole.
Will I be killed?
The big stopwatch reached 0 and went off with a brang sound. The answer man silenced it.
You asked that question just before the alarm, so I'll answer.
No, just Phil. You will not be killed.
Phil sat back in his chair and let out a breath. I don't know how you did that, sir, but it was very intense. I have to believe it was a shuck and jive. You must have known I was coming. Got some background, but you certainly earned your 25 smacks.
The answer man only smiled.
But I didn't know exactly where I was going or what road I was going to take. So how could you?
No reply. Of course not. His 5 minutes were up.
You know what? I feel weird. Swimmy. The world seemed to be going away.
The answer man was still sitting at his table, but he appeared to be withdrawing, as if on rails. Grayness began to encroach on Phil's field of vision. He raised his hands to his eyes to clear them, and gray became black.
When Phil came to, he was behind the wheel of his Chevrolet parked on the shoulder of Route 111. His watch said it was 1:20. I passed out. First time in my life. But don't they say there's a first time for everything? Passed out, yes. Pulled over first, thank God, and turned off the engine. Probably from hunger. He'd had 6 bottles of beer on Friday night, and he supposed there were calories and at least some nourishment in beer, but he hadn't had much to eat yesterday or today, so it made a degree of sense. But when you passed out, as opposed to being asleep, did you have dreams? Because he'd had a doozy. He could remember every detail. The scalloped red umbrella. The big stopwatch. Or maybe you call that sort of thing a stop clock. The answer man's salt and pepper hair. He could remember every question and every answer. It was no dream.
Yes, he said aloud. Yes, it was. Had to be.
He knew his mother's maiden name and where father was born in the dream because I knew those things. He got out of his car and walked slowly to where the answer man had been. The table was gone. The chairs were gone. But he could see marks in the soft earth where they had been. The grayness started to come back and he slapped himself hard, first on one cheek and then on the other. Then he kicked at the dirt until the marks were gone.
This never happened, he told the empty road and the blazing trees. He said it again. This never happened. He got back behind the wheel, started his engine, and pulled onto the highway. He decided he wouldn't tell Sally Ann about passing out. It would worry her, and she would probably insist that he see a doctor. It was just hunger, that was all. Hunger and the most vivid dream he'd ever had. 2 hamburgs, a Coca-Cola, and a piece of apple pie would put him right, and he was pretty sure there was a greasy spoon in Ossipee not 5 miles down the road. One good thing had come from his odd roadside fugue. No, actually 2 things. He would tell her he meant to hang out his shingle in the little town of Curry. Would she still give him her hand in marriage? Parents be damned.
Phil Parker and Sally Ann Alberton were married in Boston's Old South Church on April 29th, 1938. Ted Alberton walked his daughter down the aisle. This walk, which he had at first refused to make, was a result of his wife's diplomacy and his daughter's gentle supplications. Once he was able to think about Sal's impending nuptials calmly, Mr. Alberton realized there was another reason to make that short walk. Business. John Parker was a senior partner in the firm. Ted heartily disapproved of Phil's decision to throw away a bright future in a hick farming community, but there was the firm to think of. In the years ahead, there must be no friction between the partners. So he did his duty, but he did it with a set, unsmiling face. As he watched the ceremony, 2 old sayings came to Ted Alberton's mind. Youth must be served was one. Marry in haste, repent at leisure was the other. There was no honeymoon. Phil's parents had reluctantly opened his trust fund, $30,000, and he was anxious not to waste it. A week after the ceremony, he opened the little office next to the Sunoco station. The sign on the door, painted by his new bride, read, Philip Y. Parker, Attorney at Law. On his desk was a telephone and an appointment book full of blank pages. They did not stay blank for long. On the very afternoon he opened for business, a farmer named Regis Toomey walked in. He was wearing bib overalls and a straw hat. He was everything Phil's father had predicted. Toomey offered to take off his muddy boots, and Phil told him not to bother. I'm thinking you came by that mud honorably. Sit down and tell me why you're here. Toomey sat. He took off his straw hat and placed it on his lap.
How much do you charge?
It came out Yankee. Charge. 50% of what I get for you. If I get nothing, $25. He hadn't forgotten the answer man's little sign, and he, Phil, hoped to have answers for all sorts of people, starting with this man.
Sounds fair,
said Toomey.
Here's what. The bank wants to foreclose me and auction off the farm.
Farm?
But I've got a paper.
He brought it out of the front pocket of his bibballs and passed it across the desk.
Says I've got 90 days grace. Bank fella says that's null and void if I didn't make the last payment.
Did you?
All but $10. The wife went grocerying, don't you see? And that left me short.
Phil could hardly believe it. Are you saying the bank wants to take your farm because of a $10 shortfall?
Bank fella says so. Says they can auction it off. But I'm guessing they already have a buyer lined up.
We'll see about that, Phil said.
I don't have $25 just about now, Lawyer Parker.
Sally Ann came out of the other room with a pot of coffee. She was wearing a dark blue dress and a pinafore of a slightly lighter shade. Her face, free of makeup, shone. Her blonde hair was pulled back. Toomey was struck dumb. We'll take your case, Mr. Toomey, she said. And because it's our first, no charge, no matter the outcome. Isn't that right, Philip? Absolutely, Phil said, although he had been looking forward to that $25. What's the bank fella's name?
Mr. Lathrop,
Toomey said and grimaced like a man who's bitten into something sour.
First Bank. He's the chief loan officer and in charge of mortgages.
Phil presented himself at the First Bank of New Hampshire that very afternoon and inquired of Mr. Lathrop if his bosses would enjoy a story in the Union Leader about a cruel bank that took a farmer's property in the depths of a depression over a measly $10. After discussion, some of it fairly warm, Mr. Lathrop saw the light. I'm tempted to take you to court anyway, Phil said pleasantly. Unfair business practices, pain and suffering, financial deception.
That's outrageous, Mr. Lathrop said. You'd never win.
Perhaps not, but the bank would lose either way. I think $500 paid into Mr. Toomey's account would close this matter to the mutual satisfaction of both parties. Lathrop groused, but the money was paid. Toomey offered to fork over half, but Phil, with Sally Ann's concurrence, refused. He did take $25 when Toomey insisted, thinking of the answer man as he did it. The news spread, both in Curry and the surrounding towns. Phil discovered several banks were using the same short payment fiddle to foreclose on farms. In one case, a farmer in neighboring Hancock came up $20 short 3 months before his mortgage would have been paid off. His farm was foreclosed and then sold to a construction company for $12,000. Phil took that one to court and got $8,000 back for the farmer. Not full value, but better than nothing, and the press coverage was gold. By 1939, his little office had been refurbished, new shingles and a fresh coat of paint. Like Sally Ann's face, it shone. When the Sunoco station went bust, Phil bought it and added an associate just out of law school. Sally Ann picked out a secretary, smart but elderly and plain, who doubled as a receptionist to help him winnow his cases. By 1941, His business was in the black. The future looked bright. Then 4 years and 2 months after Phil's encounter with a man sitting under a red umbrella by the side of the road, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Not long before their wedding, Sally Ann Alberton took Phil by the hand and led him out onto the back lawn of the Alberton house in Wellesley. They sat on a bench by the goldfish pond, where a skim of ice had melted only recently. Her color was high, and she wouldn't look him in the face, but she was determined to say what was on her mind. Phil thought that on that afternoon, she had never looked more like her father. "You need to lay in a supply of French letters," she said, looking fixedly down at their linked hands. "Do you know what I'm talking about?" "Yes," Phil said. He had also heard them called English caps and, as an undergrad, naughty bags. He had worn such a thing exactly once on a trip to a house of ill repute in Providence. It was an expedition that still filled him with shame. "But why? Don't you want children?" "Of course I want children, but not until I'm sure I won't have to come begging to my parents, or you to yours, to help us out. My father would love that, and he'd put conditions on it. Strings to draw you away from what you really want to do. I can't have that. I won't have that." She snatched a quick glance at him, reading his emotional temperature, then looked back down at their linked hands again. "There is a thing for women. It's called a diaphragm. But if I ask Dr. Grayson, he'll tell my parents." "A doctor is enjoined from such behavior," Phil said. "He would do it, just the same. So, French letters. Do you agree?" He thought about asking her how she even knew about such things and decided he didn't want to know. Some questions should not be answered. "I agree." Now she did look at him. "You must buy them in Portland or Freiburg or North Conway, far from Curry, because people talk." Phil burst out laughing. "You are a sly one." "I am when I have to be," she said. His business prospered, and several times he and Sally Ann discussed throwing the French letters away. But in those first years, Phil was working farmer's hours dawn to dusk, often in court, often on the road, and the idea of adding a kitty seemed more like a burden than a blessing. Then, December 7th. "I'm going to enlist," he told Sally Ann that night. They had been listening to the radio all day. "You could get a deferment, you know. You're almost 30. "I don't want a deferment." "No," she said and took his hand. "Of course you don't. If you did, I'd love you less. Those dirty sneaking Japs." Also what? Her answer made him realize, as with the business about buying his French letters far from Curry, just how much her father's child she was. "Also, it would look bad. Business would suffer. You might be called a coward. Just come back to me, Phil. Promise." Phil remembered what the answer man had told him under the red umbrella that day in October. Not killed, not injured. He had no business believing such a thing, not all these years later. But he did. "I promise. I absolutely do." She put her arms around his neck. "Then come to bed. And never mind the damn rubber. I want to feel you in me." 9 weeks later, Phil sat in a Paris Island Quonset hut, sweating and aching in every muscle. He was reading a letter from Sally Ann. She was pregnant. On the morning of February 18th, 1944, Lieutenant Philip Parker led his contingent of the 22nd Marines ashore on the atoll of Eniwetok. The Navy had subjected the Japanese to 3 days of bombardment, and intelligence said the enemy forces were thin on the ground. Unlike most of naval intelligence, this turned out to be true. On the other hand, nobody had bothered to tell the gyrenes about the steep sand dunes they would have to climb after the Higgins boats grounded. The Japs were waiting for them, but they were armed with rifles instead of the dreaded Nambu light machine guns. Phil lost 6 of his 36, 2 killed and 4 wounded, only 1 seriously. By the time they reached the top of the dunes, the Japs had melted into the thick brush. The 22nd Marines swept west, meeting only scattered resistance. One of Phil's men was shot in the shoulder, another fell into a hole and broke his leg. Those were his only casualties after the landing.
"Walk in the park," Sergeant Myers said.
When they reached the ocean on the far side of the atoll, Phil got a walkie-talkie message from the jackleg Marine headquarters that had been set up on the other side of the dunes that had caused them the worst casualties. They could still hear scattered fire from the south, but that was dying out even as they ate a noon meal. A picnic lunch at the seashore, Phil thought. Who knew war could be so pleasant?
"What's the word, Loot?"
Myers asked when Phil holstered the walkie. "Johnny Walker says the island is secure," Phil said. He was speaking of Colonel John T. Walker, who was bossing this little farrago along with his fellow Colonel Russell Ayers.
"Don't sound secure," said Private First Class Malaki.
He nodded toward the south. But by 1500, the shooting had fizzled away to nothing. Phil waited for orders, got none, posted three guards at the edge of the overgrowth, and told the rest of the men they could fall out until further notice. At 2000 hours, they were told to pack up and head back east, where they would reconnect with the main landing force. They were grumbling about having to trek back through the thick underbrush when it would soon be dark, but orders was orders, and they saddled up. After Private Frankland broke his leg in another hole and Private Gordon nearly put out an eye running into a tree, Phil radioed headquarters and asked permission to camp for the night because the terrain was difficult.
"Fucking difficult is right," said Private First Class Malaki.
Permission was granted. They camped under their netting, but plenty of mosquitoes still got in.
"At least the ground's dry," Maya said. "I've had trench foot. It's not for sissies."
Phil fell asleep to the sound of his men slapping and Private Franklin, he with a broken leg, moaning. He awoke just before dawn, aware that shapes were moving north of their little encampment through the gloom. Hundreds of shapes. He found out later that Inuitok was riddled with spider holes. Franklin had probably broken his leg in one of them. A Japanese infantryman might have been at the bottom looking up as Wrangel and Sergeant Myers pulled him out of it. Myers now put a hand on Phil's shoulder and murmured, "Not a word, not a sound. They might miss us. I think..." That was when one of the Marines coughed. Conflicting lights crisscrossed the gray morning, grayer still under the canopy, and picked out the humped shapes swaddled in mosquito netting. The firing began. Six Marines were slaughtered in their sleep. Eight more were wounded. Only one Marine got off a shot. Myers had his arm around Phil. Phil had an arm around Myers. They listened to bullets whicker overhead, and several thumped the ground around them. Then there was a harsh command in Japanese.
"Zenpo! Zenpo!"
it sounded like, and the Nips moved on, running and crashing through the brush. "They're counterattacking," Phil said. "That's the only reason I can think of why they didn't finish us off."
"HQ being their objective?" Myers asked.
"Gotta be. Come on. You, me, anybody else who's not wounded."
"You're crazy," Myers said.
His teeth shone as his lips parted in a grin.
"I like it."
Phil counted only six men who chased after the Japanese. There might have been one or two more. Now the firing started up again ahead of them, first sporadic, then constant. Grenades crumped, and Phil heard the chatter of the dreaded Nambu. It was joined by other machine guns. Three? Four? The remaining Marines and Phil's contingent burst out of the overgrowth and saw the far side of the dunes that had given them so much trouble the day before. It was covered with Japanese soldiers headed for the lightly defended headquarters, but Phil's men were behind them. A portly Jap, perhaps the only overweight Jap in the whole army, Phil thought later, had fallen slightly behind his comrades. He was carrying a Nambu light machine gun and was festooned with belts of ammunition. Slightly ahead of him was another, thinner machine gunner. Phil drew his knife and ran at the portly soldier, feeling that if he could get that machine gun, he could do a fair amount of damage. Maybe a lot. He plunged the knife into the nape of the Jap's neck. It was his first kill, but in the heat of the moment that hardly registered. The Jap shrieked and fell forward. The skinny machine gunner ahead of him turned, raising his weapon.
"Loot! Drop! Drop!"
Meyer screamed.
Phil didn't, because in that moment he thought of the answer man. Will I be hurt? He had asked. The answer man said no. But then Phil realized he'd asked the wrong question. He had asked the right one just before his 5 minutes ran out. Will I be killed? And the answer, no, just Phil. You will not be killed. In that moment, on Inuwetok, he believed it. Perhaps because the answer man had known his mother's maiden name and where his father had been born. Perhaps because he had no other choice. The skinny Jap opened fire with his Nambu. Phil was aware of Meyer staggering backward in a spray of blood. Destry and Malaki fell on either side of him. He heard bullets whip by on both sides of his head. He was aware of tugs at his pants and shirt, as if he were being nipped by a playful puppy.